Hey, welcome back. And I see Alabama, Canada, Washington, D.C., the state of Washington, California, all lining up on the phones for Chris Alexander, editor-in-chief of Fangoria magazine. And he's got a brand new book coming out on the Twilight Zone legacy, later this year. And I know when we come back, I've got to ask Chris about some of my favorite episodes. There's something about Burgess Meredith. Always been one of my favorite character actors, and there's this one Twilight Zone I've never been able to figure out. You know, what was Rod Serling trying to tell us? I think you know the one I'm talking about. Burgess Meredith is this voracious reader. All he wants to do is be alone with his books, and his family won't let him read. He doesn't have the time to read. So what does he do? He locks himself in a vault. He's a banker, right? He goes to a bank, locks himself in the vault, and time enough at last. Then he hears or feels this tremor, this tremble, and a nuclear holocaust, right? He's like the lone survivor. Comes out of the vault. What does he find after wandering around this post-apocalyptic world? He finds a library. Paradise. He's got all the time in the world, and he's got a library full of books. Then, of course, what happens? Drops his glasses. Drops his glasses. How cruel is that? And I've never been able to figure out what was Rod Serling trying to tell us. Because, you know, a lot of these episodes were morality plays. So when we come back with Chris Alexander, I will put that to him. And I know you've got a lot of questions for Chris Alexander, whether you're a member of the Kiss Army, or you want to talk Twilight Zone or Hammer Films. We'll get to your calls when Coast to Coast continues right after this. Welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett sitting in for George Norrie. If George Norrie were a baseball player, he would be Cal Ripken Jr., the Iron Man of broadcasting. George Norrie taking a very rare night off. Chris Alexander is with us, the editor-in-chief of Fangoria magazine and the author of the upcoming book, The Twilight Zone Legacy, sort of a fan's perspective and an episode-by-episode guide. Chris, before we get to the calls, I have to ask you about that Burgess Meredith episode. Mm-hmm. Where he breaks his glasses and he's in a library, he's alone, you know, a lone survivor after a nuclear explosion, and filled a library filled with books, no glasses, seemed kind of cruel to me. What was Rod Serling trying to tell us there?
This is an interesting episode. It's one that if you saw this show, well, if you were alive and thriving in 1959 and you saw it in its premiere, the effect would have been the same as if you saw it last week. I mean, the Twilight Zone was always kind of divided between the darker, serious twist in the tale morality stories and the more whimsical, almost comedic tales. And the thing about Time Enough at Last, which is the episode you're speaking about, starring Burgess Meredith as that milquetoast who ends up surviving a nuclear holocaust and finding his library, the library of his dreams, only to have his glasses and hopes smashed in the final act, is that it is very whimsical up until that point. You know, he's this nebbish who all he wants to do is read, and just he's happy, and people treat him like absolute trash, and it's setting itself up for some sort of twist at the end where, you know, he's going to get his. He's going to, he's going to succeed. He's going to win. It's a fun episode. And yet that smashing of the glasses is a stab into the story. It's a stab into the viewer, and it's an annihilation of this character. And it just leaves you. Now, part of the beauty of it, and the beauty of every potent Twilight Zone episode, is that it leaves you with this open-ended dread where you're constantly wondering what happens next, what's going to happen to this character, and if I was that character, what would I do? And if for many Zone fans, even me as a child seeing this, the only thing I could think of was, you know, if I'm really thinking seriously about this, maybe this is the first time I even contemplated concepts of suicide. You're thinking, there's no way out of this. The only way is to just let go, because there's no hope. You're done. You're finished. And it was a very curious twist in the tale. And, you know, in the ensuing years, I befriended Ann Serling, Rod's youngest daughter. And even she can't really cite what her dad was thinking in that episode and why it ends in such a cruel, cold note. Very uncharacteristic of the show, actually.
Well, Rod Serling, he had a kind of a breakdown, I guess, after he returned from the Second World War, was kind of a broken man. And I guess maybe some of that, that just sort of manifested itself in some of these episodes. I'm sure Rod Serling felt despondent and filled with despair.
Yes, I mean, this is true. And if you research Rod's life leading up to his stint as a paratrooper in World War II, he was a happy-go-lucky kid. He was kind of the class clown, and you know, everybody loved Rod. He was very theatrical. He'd put on little plays in the basement. He was a movie junkie and loved reading, and he just loved being the center of attention. This cute little, and he was quite short in stature too. So he was just this little imp, and but very patriotic as well. And he forcibly enlisted in the war. And he was too short, really, to be a paratrooper, but it was his sheer enthusiasm was undeniable. And so he was shipped overseas, and by the time he saw action and he saw a lot of it, he came home a very broken man, both physically and mentally. He smashed his knee up, and that was a wound that he carried with him until his death at the age of 50 in 1975. So physically he was wounded, but mentally the toll, it took its toll. And obviously the work, you know, a lot of the Graded Zone episodes too are not just sociopolitical, but are diatribes, anti-war diatribes, and that the work is where he exercised those anxieties, probably most relevantly, for sure. But even then, Time Enough at Last is still a curious anomaly.
All right, you good to take some calls, Chris?
Sure.
All right, let's go to the wild card line and say hello to Jay in Alabama. Welcome aboard, Jay.
Greetings. It's cold up there, isn't it?
Yes.
It's bikini weather.
Yes, compared to what it was here. The Creature from the Black Lagoon, I watched the 50s movie as a child. Is that going to be redone? And then the strangest Rod Serling compilation I thought I ever saw was Captain Kirk or William Shatner on the plane, and there's a demon grinding and biting the wing off the plane. That was really strange, too. What was he thinking on that?
All right, well, that's a twofold question. Let's go back to the first part about the 1954, I want to say, 54, 55. I don't have that information in front of me, but we'll say it's 54, 55, directed by Jack Arnold, who would go on to make Gilligan's Island. But Creature from the Black Lagoon, which is one of the last gasps of the classic Universal monster movies. And curious, it was released in 3D, too. And if you ever get the chance to see that movie in 3D, do, because it's absolutely fantastic. The underwater photography is amazing in 3D. But, it's funny about that one. It's been kind of trapped in development hell for a long time. And it's one of the few, if not only, Universal monster movies that has not been remade and done to death. And I'm not exactly sure why. The Gill Man is a terrifying creature.
Yeah.
And that movie itself, you know, Creature from the Black Lagoon is a lot of fun. I wouldn't say it's held up as well as say, the Wolfman or any of these other classic gothic stories. In a sense, it's kind of cheesy and
strange,
hokey, you know. But yeah, no, it's been in development hell. There's been scripts. There's been people attached. It's had the green light. Then it's been stopped, started. Maybe by and large, the people with the money don't think that today's audiences are going to buy a half fish man marauding around the countryside. I'm not
sure. They got to make it strange. They can do it. Hollywood. It was like the remake of War of the Worlds. Even though I don't like Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
And all right, Jay in Alabama.
Of Captain Kirk on the plane. And
yeah, the second question, that was in season, I want to say it's season 5 of The Twilight Zone, which was the weirdest season. It was the most overtly sci-fi and fantasy. Not as much morality or allegory, more just straight-up horror. And that was Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, starring William Shatner, a pre-Kirk William Shatner, we might add, because, you know, Shatner did have a career before he was cast as Captain Kirk. As a neurotic on the plane who hates to fly and is adamant that he sees something on the wing ripping it apart. And, of course, he's labeled a loony until the final act when you realize that, of course, everybody kind of realizes that, well, maybe there was something to the story. Now, that's a great psychological portrait of a man breaking down. If there's any flaws in that episode at all, it's the fact that the demon itself, the little gremlin on the wing, is clearly just some very short person in a shag rug. So the special effects haven't really held up, but the story itself has. And it's one of the few episodes that You know, the Twilight Zone has seen a few remakes. There's been a few. There was an 80s Twilight Zone, and there was a more recent Twilight Zone where they remade some of the stories. But 1983, there was Twilight Zone the movie, which was a failed enterprise, save for that one episode that remade Nightmare at 20,000 Feet with John Lithgow, where they improved on the special effects, and arguably Lithgow's performance is the best of his career in that particular one. So if you haven't seen that, seek it out.
It's an amazing episode in the sense it has become such a part of pop culture. It's been parodied on The Simpsons.
Yeah. Yes.
And I look at that episode. That episode did for frequent flyers what yes. Jaws did for swimmers.
Or Psycho did for showers. Absolutely. The same kind of tapping into that primal fear of being trapped and isolated in a zone where you cannot escape, and it's alien territory. You know, and you're not getting out of this one. And a beautifully done episode for sure.
You mentioned that in season 5.
I just got to step in there. One more note about that particular episode. It was written by the great Richard Matheson, who wrote I Am Legend and several episodes of The Twilight Zone. And we just lost him this year past, and probably one of the greatest sci-fi fantasy writers of all time.
Ah, okay. That's interesting. I wasn't aware that he wrote I Am Legend.
Yes.
What a career. Wow.
Yes, yes.
Spanning like 50 years.
Absolutely. And then I Am Legend. I mean, there would be no zombie subgenre if it wasn't for I Am Legend, because although they are vampires that take over the world, they are ostensibly the living dead. They are ghouls. And George Romero ripped that novel off, and admittedly, to make Night of the Living Dead. And so no Matheson, no zombies.
All right, let's go to the international line and say hello to Jeffrey in Canada. Hello, Jeffrey.
Richard,
how are you there?
Such a delight. It's been about 6 years since you and I have spoken on the air. I hope that Aphrodite and the twins are doing well.
Greatly appreciate it. Yes, indeed.
Yes,
thank you, Jeff.
They are. Good. With regards to that Burgess Meredith with the books, when the glasses break, it reminded me so much of that scene from The Lord of the Flies when Piggy's glasses get broken.
Right, you know? Right. And, interesting.
Yes, and I also felt that episode was almost a reverse Pollyanna situation, you know, because Pollyanna came out approximately at the same time. Me being 60 years of age, I grew up with all this stuff, especially Billy Mumy, you're a bad, bad man, you
right,
know. And,
right.
and
off you go to the cornfield.
Yes, and it's actually kind of funny because two nights ago on the Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson, Bill Shatner was on talking about gremlins on the plane, on the wing. But the one thing that I wanted to mention, and that was, is that there was an episode that was written by Ray Bradbury,
mm-hmm.
and it reminds me so much now about how the internet is actually running our lives, because in that episode, the telephone system refuses to allow the telephone repair guy to do any modifications. And I remember there's a repairman being up a pole, and he's actually, if my memory serves me correctly, is he not shocked or something like that? And the system will not allow him to do what he wants to do because the system has now taken over, taken a life of its own?
This is interesting. First of all, I don't think the episode in question is a Bradbury episode.
Oh, okay.
I think it's a Matheson episode. I'm not sure. Maybe, are you sure that's a Zone episode, or is
Outer Limits?
I might
perhaps
be confusing it, but it just but
there definitely. I mean, there definitely are episodes of the Twilight Zone, you know, Printer's Devil, things like that. That you know, that speak to and suggest and anticipate
a technology
what you're
taking
about.
Over.
Yeah, but the only Bradbury episode I can, off the top of my skull, that I can think of that he actually wrote for the Twilight Zone, or that was adapted for the Twilight Zone, was I Sing the Body Electric, which is again another play on technology, but it's still relevant. And it was the one where the children are the widowed father with his children,
right?
And they go to a shop that makes robot nannies, robot grandmothers, right?
Yes, and they almost have an appearance like the Children of the Damned.
Yeah, they're very angelic and blonde and Aryan. Yes. And this robot grandmother steps in and is initially rejected as being a poor substitute for
all
their
mother. Missing is the glowing eyes.
Right, but and it becomes their surrogate mother, and it's quite a moving episode. Again, no allegory or metaphor in there at all. Just a great science fiction story, well told.
Jeffrey, well, thanks for the call.
Gentlemen. Richard,
good to
once
hear from
again,
you.
Delight to speak with you.
I appreciate it. You mentioned Bill Mumy, and yeah. Of course he's in the you know that the classic episode where he's sending anyone he doesn't like into the cornfield. Is that A Good Life?
Yeah, it's A Good Life, which was again as I mentioned, Twilight Zone has been. Revisited several times with varying results, most unsuccessfully recently. And there was a sequel to that. It's still A Good Life, of course, not very creatively monikered, but where Mumy returns as the adult version of that child. And but yeah, nothing can touch that initial episode. That I think at the end of it, it's another one of those zone episodes that doesn't function on any other kind of level outside of just sheer dread and sheer horror. And I think Serling addresses that in the closing narration where he basically says, you know, no message here, no itinerary, nothing up my sleeve. This is just simply showing you a slice of this nightmarish world, and we'll leave you with that. Good night. And yeah, there's no beginning and no end to that. It's just a slice of hell of this little evil demon seed who has this town by the nuts. And it's very, very fun. Bizarre, spooky episode.
Well, I think we've all known one of those Bill Mumy characters.
Yeah, absolutely we have, yeah.
I have to ask you about the other Bill Mumy character, which I've seen several times, and every time I see it, it still, you know, sends a chill. And that's, he receives Bill Mumy, I believe it's Bill Mumy, he receives this phone call, and it's a telephone call from the dead, his grandmother calling him from the other side.
Mm,
and again, yeah. I don't know what Serling was, he was messing with her head, and he succeeded.
Well, that's in season two. It's an interesting episode. It's written by the great Charles Beaumont, who died far too young, who, along with Matheson and Serling, were, you know, the trifecta, really, of the great writers for that show. It's called Long Distance Call. And again, yes, Billy Mumy plays a little boy. He's very young in that, too. I think he made this 2 years before he made It's a Good Life. So he's probably about six or seven in this episode. And his grandmother is this domineering woman who... you know, tries to steal the affections of the child away from the mother and hoards and keeps the child to herself. And she passes on. And yet somehow, some way, she reaches out from the other side through the child's toy telephone. And the darkness of this tale was she's not reaching out to soothe or to massage any fears the boy has. Instead, she's suggesting that the boy kill himself so that he can join her on the other side. And it's how the boy keeps trying to commit suicide, and the parents have to stop him at the border. It's very, very dark. And the interesting thing about that episode is that in one of the flaws in season two, and if you're a big Zone fan, this is a sore point, really, is that the Twilight Zone, you know, the power of the Zone wasn't just Serling's writing, although that was the primary thrust of it. It was the aesthetics. It was the craft. These, you know, all the guys who were making film noir in Hollywood went to television, and this is where they ended up, on the Twilight Zone and Perry Mason. So the look of it was richly shot on film, richly lit for black and white, shadowy, shuddery, and this otherworldly. And yet the producers of the show were very cautious of cost. So come season two, they attempted to instead shoot the series on video. Cheap video, cheap dollies. And that was one of the episodes. There's a handful of them in season two. Thankfully, they realized how flawed that was.
Okay, I've got to jump in here. Chris, hear that music percolating up. We'll take a timeout, come back. More of my conversation with Chris Alexander from Fangoria Magazine and The Twilight Zone Legacy. My name is Richard Serrett, sitting in for George Norrie here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett sitting in for George Norrie. Some of you may know me from my... weekly radio broadcast up here in Canada, The Conspiracy Show. Happy Chinese New Year. You know, I was just recently looking up my year on the Chinese Zodiac. Of course, we're now entering the year of the horse, 2014, the year of the horse. Hope it's a good one. I'm a horse lover. And one of my favorite quotes is from Winston Churchill. He said, "The outside of a horse is good for the inside of a man." Something remarkable about that animal and the bond that horses have with humans. So hopefully that bodes well for 2014. But looking at my birth sign on the zodiac, and I'm a rabbit. Turns out I'm a rabbit. And I'm thinking about, you know, the conspiracy show that I do, and it makes perfect sense, right? Because I spend a lot of my time running down the rabbit hole. We'll get back to our conversation with Chris Alexander and our little homage to Rod Serling of The Twilight Zone. And we'll also get to your calls. Jerry's holding in Washington, D.C., and we've got Richard in the state of Washington. Shirley in Iowa, if you've got a line, hold on to it. And we'll delve further into The Twilight Zone. And time permitting, we'll talk about Chris Alexander's new film, just released. It's called The Queen of Blood. And wait till you find out how he made this movie. Quite a remarkable story. Back with more of Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Chris Alexander from Fangoria Magazine stays with us. And Chris, that's just one of the magazines that you're editing. We mentioned the Kiss magazine, and there's a new Kiss fanzine coming out in 2014. Before we get back to The Twilight Zone, tell us a little bit about the latest incarnation of the Kiss magazine.
Well, it's still a work in progress. We haven't quite found the eye of the needle, but if you go to kissonline.com, expect an announcement coming very soon as to what the magazine will be and how you can get it. But it will be an ongoing magazine, you know, celebrating the legacy, the 40-year legacy of the band. They're being inducted or into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year. It's a big deal. The band's still active and arguably more popular than they ever were. It's like Fangoria, you know, it's funny. It's all kind of interconnected there. This is a band that the fan base spans generations. You know, these aren't just, you know, men in their 60s who followed this band since they were kids. These are our grandfathers who are bringing their grandkids to the shows. So the legacy is huge. Obviously, the brand, it's not just a band, it's a brand. So the merchandise is everywhere. You can go somewhere in the remote jungles of the Amazon, and people will know, if you show them a picture of Gene Simmons, they'll know that that's the guy from Kiss. So,
and Gene is writing the foreword to your book.
He is, you know, and it's funny. When I put Gene on the cover, I ventured, it was a similar, I didn't have to eat any penises, but I did venture to L.A. to Gene's house and Paul Stanley's house as well. It was a great day, two of my idols, and got to have sit with them in their homes and discuss monsters. And Gene and I have maintained a somewhat, you know, I don't say we go bowling on Friday nights or anything, but we have maintained a friendship over the last few years. He's written for the magazine a couple times, and Fangoria magazine, that is. And we've maintained that friendship. So he did write a rather beautiful, articulate foreword for this book, and I couldn't be more thrilled that he did that. So it's very exciting for me personally.
All right, let's go west of the Rockies, and Richard is in, is it Bow or Bow, Washington?
Hey, Richard. Hey, good evening. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hello.
Yeah. Hi, whereabouts in Washington? You're in the Washington State. Is it Bow or Bow?
Bow, as in bow tie.
Bow tie. Excellent. Welcome aboard.
Bow, Washington.
All right, your question for Chris Alexander.
Well, I got not a question. I got a comment and a real quick story. That Burgess Meredith story. I watched the Twilight Zone when I was a little boy back in the late 60s, early 70s. Anyway, that one there, when that one ended, it was like telling me, you want to be the only one left in hell? Anyway, now the story. The long and the short of it is, it was a troubled and really disturbing time in my life. And one day, I woke up out of a coma, about 2 weeks in a coma, right smack in the middle of a Twilight Zone episode.
A real-life episode, you mean? Like a real-life Twilight Zone, or something you saw it on TV when you woke up?
When I woke up, I was in psychosis.
Oh, dear.
So I was right smack in the middle of a Twilight Zone episode. And I cannot remember to this day what the name of it is, but I remember it ever since then. Even as a little boy, it was my favorite one. It was the one where the people had the pig nose and the hair.
I'll stop you right there, my friend. What a great episode. Not great, but, you know, an appropriate episode to wake up to after such a traumatic experience.
Oh, boy, it was so weird. But I did have one friend throughout the whole thing who kept me connected to reality. He was the only one I could believe that he was real.
Well, you got to have one of those. You got to have one of those buddies. Now, where was that episode, Chris? Tell me about that episode.
I haven't been in any trouble since. I really love the show.
Well, if you're keen to revisit that part of your history via The Twilight Zone, that episode is called Eye of the Beholder.
Eye of the Beholder, how fitting.
It's a masterful episode in that you do not see anyone's face except for the chief character, who's wrapped in bandages. She's going through a procedure because apparently she's hideously, atrociously ugly. And this is the last attempt that these doctors, and you never see their faces, are doing on this person to try and make her an acceptable, visually acceptable member of society. Meanwhile, well, bubbling in the background, where it's clear we're in a kind of dystopian
world. And one of the scariest part was one of the doctors in there have kept coming up and giving me this breather because my lungs were congested or whatever. I don't know what, but some kind of a breather. And I did not want him doing it to me, but I couldn't move because I'd been in a coma for 2 weeks and I just couldn't move.
Well, thank God you didn't suffer the same fate as that character. When she's unmasked, it turns out that she is beautiful. The world is ugly, and you're right. They all have.
Well, it told me that, hey, man, we all have our place.
That's right.
Indeed. Hey, Richard, thanks for the call. Great to hear from Washington. That's great news. Let's say hello to first time caller Louie in California. Hello, Louie.
Hey, how's it going?
Very well, thanks.
First, I just wanted to just bring up my favorite episode, and that was The Howling Man.
Oh, yeah. Excellent.
That was just so great, the way they held the devil.
Yep.
And the special effects were just top-notch.
Very practical. You're talking about the part where he turns into the devil, and it's just him walking. It's almost a time lapse.
The way every time he passes the column, he just looks more and more.
Yes, fantastic episode. Charles Beaumont, again, wrote that episode, one of the last he contributed to the zone before his untimely demise. And, based on his short story, fantastic episode.
Thanks for the call.
Great.
Chris, when we were talking about sort of the trajectory of the series, The Twilight Zone, and you mentioned that at some point they experimented with a one-hour format versus the half hour. They experimented with video, then went back to film. What was going on? I mean, there were a lot of similar shows, I guess, by around season 3 or 4, One Step Beyond, and I think The Outer Limits came in around the same time. Was that sort of fueling the changes with the experimentation with the format?
Well, Twilight Zone, you know, contrary to its popularity, I mean, if anything ever defines the word cult series or cult movie or cult show, I mean, that was Twilight Zone because it had an instant cult. It was a water cooler show. Everyone would talk about it the next day. It was never a huge ratings winner in the sense that, you know, it just was not the big juggernaut mass appeal show. It had its place. And it was incredibly popular, and critics loved it, but it wasn't the big ratings winner. So it always had trouble, and by the time, hence why they were doing economical things like flipping to video and trying to curb their expenses. But it was actually canceled at one point, and it returned in this one-hour format that was an attempt to try and compete with some of the other hour, like Outer Limits was an hour-long show, for instance, and that was doing fairly well, and that was its competitor. So the hour-long format, which came in season 4, is, you know, and again, I can't think of any bad Twilight Zone episode, but if I'm going to cite any that are weaker than others, they would be within the confines of that season, because the beauty of the Zone was that half-hour format, those three acts, and that sting and the tail, perfectly condensed and the perfect micro-platform for Serling to spin his yarns. But by the time he got to season 4, with those one-hour ones, it was neither fish nor fowl. So you had too much time, these little stories spread out over an hour, or there was too much tale and not enough time. These were feature films, but the running time wasn't long enough to develop the ideas fully. So they didn't quite work. Now, there are a few gems in that season. You know, the one episode with Dennis Hopper as the neo-Nazi who is guided by this shadowy force who turns out to be the ghost of Hitler is one of the most magnetic of that run. But by and large, those episodes are more of a curio than as effective as Twilight Zone at its peak.
I forgot about Dennis Hopper. I mean, that series launched so many careers. Dennis Hopper, I believe Robert Duvall was in an early episode of The Twilight Zone. Jack Klugman.
Right.
Although I think Klugman had a career prior to The Twilight Zone.
He did, but Klugman and Meredith, again, the myriad episodes. They were in the several key episodes of The Zone. They were, when you think of the major players within that show, you close my eyes, I can see Klugman and Meredith's face. They were there. So the major part of that, the legacy for sure.
Let's go back to the wild card line and say hello to Shirley in Iowa. Hello, Shirley.
Hello, Phantasmagoric. Mr. Alexander, you are fantastic.
Oh, well, thank you very much. So are you. Thank you.
What a writer. And I'm such, it's such a privilege to be talking to you because I like to write as well. And I'll tell you, the best one I like, because I started watching these shows way back when they first had Sarkozy's horror shows with the devil.
Right.
You know, that devil actually looked like a devil in that black and white film they made that was, you couldn't, there was no speaking on it at all. That was the scariest show I've ever seen in my whole life, and I still can remember that.
Which show is this? I'm sorry. Which one?
Oh, Sarkozy's had one with the devil.
Oh.
And he made one with Cleopatra, but they were the silent films. And
right.
When the devil came out of the darkness, I never had seen such a horrible, horrible picture of a devil. Roddy McDowall was good, you know, at that. But this was the worst and most scariest, besides Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. That was something that I've never seen. And I saw that as an adult, and it scared the heck out of me. And I saw it at night.
Wow.
All right, well, Shirley, appreciate the call.
That is the best time to enjoy things like this. And it had the greatest effect is when you're alone and you're in that dark place. And you experience these entertainments, that's when it leaves the most impact, for sure.
Thanks for checking in from Iowa, Shirley. Chris, we've got about 10 minutes here before the top of the hour, and then we'll say goodnight. But I have to ask you about this feature film that you've just released called
right.
The Queen of Blood. Now, this is a sequel, as I understand it. Tell us a little bit about The Queen of Blood, and then tell us how you actually made this movie, because this is fascinating to me.
Well, Queen hasn't been released yet. It will be released this year. It will be after a festival run. Hopefully in the spring or summer we'll see the international Blu-ray and DVD release. Like my previous movie, my first movie, which I wrote, directed, edited, I did the music for it. It's a labor of love. And they're interesting movies in the sense they are kind of sequels to each other. They're more reinventions of each other's universes. And they're very, 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 very personal and non-commercial movies. I think you either love them or hate them, and that's by design. They're ostensibly vampire movies, but really, the way I see them anyways, are kind of vampiric renditions of Roman Polanski's Repulsion in many respects. I have a female vampire, the lead, magnetically played by a Toronto actress named Shauna Henry, who is, I guess, on the surface, a vampire running around the streets, masquerading as a prostitute, drinking the blood of her victims and vomiting it up. And in the sequel, reinvented as a kind of in the Wild West, using her fingers to drink the blood of her victims. But really what I think they are is the fever dreams of a very mentally ill woman. And I intend them as a trilogy. They don't cost very much money. We won a lot of awards for the first round, and it was seen all around the world. People either, again, love it or hate it. This one's a major step up, but it's still a nickel and dime movie. And as you say, the way we shot them was very quickly, obviously, as a part-time endeavor. But I used my iPhone for the first one extensively, and the second one, many of the key images in the film were done on the fly using my iPhone to capture them, the iPhone being a 1080 pixel digital source, so that there's no flaw in the image. But that all goes to my philosophy, you know, growing up, and that, you know, reading Fangoria and seeing these artists making these movies, and that it's not what you got, it's what you do with it. So yeah, we made these movies very, very cheaply, with maximum impact, using what we had at our disposal, including our iPhones. So
did you not edit the first film, Blood for Irina? Was that not also edited on an iPhone?
No, it was not edited. It was, but it was edited using the most base of consumer software, which is a challenge. I mean, to me, again, it's a labor of love. I do these things not because I'm making a living yet out of making any films. You know, that'd be a lovely twist of fate if that could ever happen. But I do it to challenge myself, again, handling every aspect of production. And using the crudest of software is something that, you know, you kind of take your cues from the Russians, you know, Potemkin, Eisenstein. This is a guy who was using this crude pre-war equipment that even when the Russian film industry took off and they could afford to import state-of-the-art equipment, they did not, because they developed a language using this crude equipment. And that's kind of the way I operate, using a lot of analog and base equipment, because I understand.
Did you go to film school?
I did, but I dropped out very quickly because I was kind of aghast at all these out-of-work artists telling me what art was, and it didn't appeal to me whatsoever. I still do have a very specific, clear idea of how I want to communicate my ideas, and I don't think... You know, Roger Corman was my teacher, listening to the audio commentary in the Pit and the Pendulum DVD. To me, drop out of film school now, get the MGM, out of print, but you can still get it cheaply, MGM edition of Pit and the Pendulum, and listen to the audio commentary if you really want to know how to make movies, market movies, if you want to understand the art and commerce of filmmaking. That's all you need, man, and it won't cost you thousands of dollars. It'll cost you like $5. That's all you need.
Oh, you mentioned Roger Corman, and of course, Vincent Price, one of my heroes, and just a wonderful, wonderful actor and a great presence. Did you ever meet Vincent Price?
Oh, God, no. I remember Vincent Price passed, if not the same day, then in the same week that River Phoenix passed. And I was in high school at the time, and I was devastated about the passing of Price, although obviously the tragedy wasn't as, the magnitude wasn't there, because Price lived a long, healthy, happy life, and just died of age, and whereas River Phoenix died of over-medicating. But all the media attention, I recall vividly, was all over the death of and the tragedy of River Phoenix's passing, and nary a mention of Price's passing, which I found just horrible, a horrible, horrible thing. But never got a chance to meet Price, and but man, I'm almost glad I didn't, because some of these icons, once you meet them, you know, again, you're the wizard behind the curtain, and it becomes very, obviously, they're just ordinary people. But Price, to me, will always be one of those people that seem like he's beamed in from another dimension. There's so much mystery and larger-than-life aura around this guy that I'm almost glad he exists in that bubble for me forever.
And you mentioned Roger Corman. Corman, now well up in his 80s, still making movies, I gather.
He is, and a very good friend of mine, man. A really interesting guy who, you know, you get him on the phone now. If you call up Roger, well, he'd probably be sleeping right now, but call him tomorrow and ask him anything you want to ask him about his past, his present, and his future, which is key to his longevity, in that Roger Corman lives in the now, and he lives for tomorrow. He loves to work. He's a workaholic. He's a visionary, always has been. And even though the films he's making right now, you know, giant octopuses fighting sharks and nonsense like that, it doesn't matter. He's making movies, and he's almost 90, and he's spry and athletic. And the reason for that, I think, is because he didn't peak at a certain period in his life. He doesn't dwell on the past, and he lives for now. So Corman, a huge inspiration to me personally and professionally.
So we can look forward to the theatrical release of The Queen of Blood and The Twilight Zone Legacy. The publisher is...
Bear Manor Media, an amazing niche publisher that releases the most unlikely biographies. One of my favorite books that Bear Manor spat out, and this was kind of the deal sealer for me to seek them out to publish this, was the Alan Reid autobiography, which...
Okay, gotta run, Chris, but we'll look forward to that. The Twilight Zone Legacy, thank you for this. Chris Alexander, open lines. Open lines, you, me, and the telephone, when Coast to Coast continues here on the Big Coast Network.